Well, most mornings don't start off quite as delightful as this morning. Usually they start pretty darn delightful, but this is very special. We have a great group this morning, and I would say this was curated by Teresa Bourgeois, who asked to have all of these wonderful women on our panel today joining Alan and I, and we're very thrilled to have them here. And so I'll introduce them in just a second. I do want to remind you, however, that you can be a part of our program, and it's panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. MC.org is how you can get in, and we will talk to you about what is going on. There are a lot of things going on. I think we all want to talk about some good news, but there's a lot of bad news to talk about as well. So hopefully we will do a fresh mix of both, and we'll get into that in just a second. In the meantime, good morning, Alan Chartok. How are you?
Good morning. Good morning, and it was really great in Great Barrington this morning.
There you go. The emphasis on great and bear, I think.
And right? Barrington.
Yes, Great Barrington.
Yeah.
Good to have you here. Siena College Professor of Comparative Politics, Vera Acarius-Kelly. Good morning, Vera.
Good morning, and it's a good one because we have some women power in the room.
It's a very, very strong...
I was not the one who said woohoo, for the record.
That was Alan.
Woohoo!
Come on, Alan. Work with us.
It's
going to
be all right, Alan. It's going to be all right.
Work with us. I like it.
Joe's off track now.
You know what I was just thinking of is like when I got an award one time and from Hubbard Hall, and don't be mad at me if I got this wrong, but all four of you showed up.
Of course,
yes. That was very lovely, yes. And that always has meant a great deal to me. And I love that you're all friends, and just very nice that you're here. So Vera, good morning, welcome, wonderful to have you. I will tell you, I was surprised this morning because I did think one of our guests was going to be joining us by phone. And lo and behold, they got in their vehicle and they drove the 90 minutes over here, and we're more than a little thrilled. We haven't seen her in a bit, and it's great to have her here. Research professor and Stuart Rice Honorary Chair at the University of Massachusetts Amherst's College of Information and Computer Sciences, and faculty associate at the Berkman Klein Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, Fran Berman. Good morning,
Whoa.
Fran.
And Joe is so surprised that I'm still short. What happened?
Well, I know. We still managed to hug.
And he's tall.
Yeah.
Now, those two hugged, and it was really something to see.
Well, I'm going to complain to Siena College for having such a short title.
You know what? Takes the entire show.
2 points on that. One is that Jim Handler, who I think had a somewhat longer title than you,
yeah,
only somewhat, just got a new title, and it is a little bit shorter. They put more in there as far as, you know, just using words like information and tech.
Well, so, he just gets cooler as time
right.
goes on.
King of the tether war.
So that yeah. guy,
I mean, he
yeah.
says
yeah.
king of the tether war. That's what he is.
So that's.
I'm not sure that sounds.
That's cool, but you still win with the longest title.
Yes, yes.
So congratulations.
Well, I just want to tell our listeners, you know, welcome to WAMC Slumber Party Edition.
It's great to have you here. Also, by the way, I don't know if you know this, but our friend Terry Gibson is coming to Harvard.
He is.
Yeah,
he is.
He's starting to lecture at Harvard on public speaking and communications, and will
nice.
Be starting in the fall. So,
oh, he'll be great.
Yeah,
yeah he will.
So,
be.
And that's a full time gig for him. He's, nice. He still will be on our show.
Nice.
But
I don't
know if he'll drive the like this, Fran did. But.
This program is going uptown.
Yeah, very not
How
bad.
Do I get one of those gigs?
Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, and president of Beyond Plastics. And to prove to you what a big deal today was, Judith said, I won't even do Friday. I'll do Thursday. Good morning, Judith.
Good morning.
You?
Everyone out there, today is Thursday. Do not go.
Yeah, I know.
It's not Friday.
What is this? The Coho City Director of Operations, meaning she runs the damn town. Teresa Bourgeois is with us. Good morning, Teresa. How are you?
I'm just doing very, very well, and delighted to be here with everyone, and thanks for bringing us all together, Joe.
Well, thank you. All right, we are thrilled. Let's get started, and we'll have fun this morning. It's really good to have you all here. We've got a lot of things to discuss. I just want to quickly point out something that Judith pointed out to me last night, which is we are expecting, because of Stephen Breyer's retirement at noon today, and then the immediate swearing in of Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson, an historic, and that is a good news story, that'll be happening today. So what we are expecting is the last of the Supreme Court decisions to be announced prior to Justice Breyer retiring. With that said, we are expecting a decision by the Supreme Court on the EPA. And it is a much-watched decision, and environmentalists like Judith and others are very concerned about it. So we will be awaiting that. So when that comes,
it'll come at 10.
Yeah, 10, but I will say if it comes today, I assume it's coming today. Yes. It seems like everybody believes
it has to come today.
So,
and I'm a little nervous about reading it during a live radio show, and I am feeling
and
a
not
little
swearing.
Feeling a little nauseous right now. Right. Worried about it.
Well,
that and the immigration case are both coming down today, which both of them will be transformational.
So we will get to those in those topics in just a moment. In the meantime, we will go to other subjects, and that begins with abortion and abortion enforcement. In looking at the decision that was delivered on Friday of last week, we now have in states banning abortion a growing rift over how you enforce that. These rifts have emerged among the hundreds of elected district attorneys who will be charged with enforcing the expanding restrictions on abortion, creating, and I think this is the correct word, but it's a good word, balkanized new legal system within states that are banning the procedure. Dozens of Democratic prosecutors who represent liberal pockets in conservative states already have vowed to resist bans by refusing to bring charges against abortion providers. But in many rural areas and outlying suburbs, conservative prosecutors have said they will enforce their state bans. An opening salvo came this week, just days after the Supreme Court struck down the right to abortion, when a prominent anti-abortion group in Texas urged the police and prosecutors in Dallas and Houston to open criminal investigations into three abortion clinics that the group said were preparing to violate the law by scheduling abortions. It is your duty to uphold the law and investigative crimes, the group Texas Right to Life said in its letter, in which it claimed to have phone recordings of clinic employees saying, "We urge you and your officers to investigate this abortion clinic." That's from them. The demand was quickly made moot when a judge temporarily blocked an attempt to resurrect the state's long dormant century-old abortion law in the weeks before a new ban takes effect. But it marked the beginning of an explosive new battle over abortion in America, which is how prosecutors and the police will enforce laws that criminalize abortion in 24 states, some of them carrying penalties of up to 15 years in prison. Mm. What do you think? Who wants the first word on this? Alan?
Well, with a room full of very distinguished women, I think it would be presumptive for me to say anything. So I'm going to pass to Fran.
There you go.
No. Isn't this the good news show? Just to make a general comment, there's not an individual woman and otherwise that I know that isn't just devastated by this and really sees it as even more than the really disturbing news is that it's just sort of a marker that we live in a different kind of society that feels like it's going backwards fast. And one of the things I wanted to bring up from my own background is this is a perfect storm of surveillance intrusion and personal physiological intrusion. And I am reading a lot now that basically talks about how in the 21st century, at this point in time, we can use all of these digital technologies to make things worse. And what's interesting to me is all the kinds of workarounds people are thinking about it. Anything from people within the tech industry themselves, saying their personal beliefs are pro-choice and they don't believe that companies should be working with law enforcement or that they should be collecting the data to individuals trying to decide, you know, do I just take the period tracker off my phone or, mm-hmm. you know, is yes. there a way I can, yes. You know, mess up my location stuff so, you know, people can't figure out what's going on. To companies that deliver Plan B and morning after pills over the internet, and if they cross state lines, are there problems? To people who are thinking about, now I have to travel to a different state if they want an abortion. So you're just seeing kind of across the landscape all these different things. And, you know, fundamental questions that we're going to have to ask. If you say something in a home with an Alexa about an abortion, can that be subpoenaed? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, can Amazon Pharmacy, you know, send you stuff? You know, can law enforcement take all of this information? So, you know, if state attorney generals in this highly balkanized space, if the person in my county doesn't want to bring those charges and the person in the next county does, you know, what does that mean? Mm-hmm. So it's a mess.
I was going to say it is a mess. I was struck by reading some of the of what you were just talking about. And in the early days, I was thinking, well, they're not going to, like, that seems to be a bridge too far. Mm-hmm. They're not going to go do that, listen to people. And then you have some Texas or Arizona district attorney get up and say, we're going to be monitoring every, and then you get scared, right?
Yeah. Well, one of the stories you shared, Joe, I mean, I've been concerned about data collection for a long time and that people just not thinking about how much data is collected on them because of the tools that they use and it's collected and sold and whatever. But one of them, this fact was astounding. Google fielded 50,907 requests from January to June last year for data from
law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Four times the number it got during the same period in 2016. 82% of those requests resulted in Google sharing the information.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
50,000 requests for data for prosecutions. Mm-hmm. And so
I can't take credit for that, by the way. That was all Fran.
Oh, thanks, Fran. Okay. Thanks. Yeah. But I don't think people understand it. With a lot of these tools that they use, they are the product. They are not the customer. We say this all the time. Facebook, Fitbit, all, like, Fran, you would do the litany better than me. But it's astounding, and I don't think people, at least I was focused on will prosecutors prosecute, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But this data issue and how much data is collected and the intrusion into people's lives is astounding.
Vera?
So one of the big questions that I always reflect on is I've traveled, well, pre-COVID, I traveled a lot, and I went to a lot of really repressive countries. And I'm familiar with the machinations of security states and surveillance states. And I'm starting to feel like I live in one.
Oh, you do?
Oh, absolutely.
In terms of not only technology-wise, but now I would say to women who are considering living in states where access to all variants of healthcare, women's well healthcare, are not available and they cannot access the Plan B medication or abortion services, be very careful who you speak with in person, because what it reminds me of is I had relatives in East Germany, and we know from the Stasi data that family members reported on family members in terms of what they said in the house, children on parents, neighbors on neighbors. So you have to be extremely careful now in the state of Texas, for example, and several others, who you tell and who you trust. So let's say you are pregnant and you want to, you know, your circumstances don't allow for you to have a child at this time, and you are speaking to friends and you trust your friends not to to provide you with advice and to give you some maybe help or to operate in the way that they are sounding board. Well, you can't do that anymore because people talk to other people.
Well,
people are now dangerous.
Definitely not on email. And I think I hear your point. I think the bigger concern is technology, mm-hmm. and sharing information and, you know, well, direct messages, mm-hmm. emails, social media.
Yep.
I mean, we always tell our teenage and adult children, mm-hmm. you know, don't post anything that you don't want to have come up in a job interview, and they don't listen to us.
No, they don't.
yes, and you're right. I think the technology piece uh-huh. is really, I mean, I'm not.
Yeah, yeah,
I'm
no,
not
I know, but I'm saying,
that,
you know, of course, be aware. You know, don't post on social media that, oh, I think I might be pregnant or something like that. That would be not good because you could be traced for that. But there are people who will report you if they think, you know, personal friends or family members will try to restrict your ability to make choices now. I think both you have to watch out for. Yeah.
Well, it's not happening exactly yet. I mean, at mm-hmm. this point in time, those who have been victimized are typically the providers rather than the users of this. But of course, you know, as you correctly say, it is a small step mm-hmm. To victimize the people who seek abortion.
Well, we
services.
Have women, a couple of cases in Texas where women had miscarriages, yes. as right. we all know, yeah. and then were accused of aborting their children because physically, when you examine a woman, it can look the same, right, mm-hmm. to right. a physician. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those cases were overturned in the end, but the future might look very different. Right. We have those kinds of legal concerns in Central America, for example, where women are victimized in El Salvador in high numbers. They're in the countryside. They're not highly educated. They don't have access to medical services. But if you are accused of having aborted your child, even if you have a miscarriage, you spent a decade in jail. And you have no ability to defend yourself, right? And is this what we are facing in this country again? It's shocking.
Well, I do think that, and that gets to the issue of the economic divide, I think this will affect people regionally differently, but most importantly, economically differently, as do so many other, you know, we saw it
around. And also a big difference between race. How it will affect men and women.
Right. Well.
Oh.
yeah. Well.
And let's, yeah. Where's the movement for mass vasectomies?
I mean, yeah. let's.
Well, there is one, right?
Yeah,
there is
right.
one.
It's weak. It's
and
weak.
It's there, but yeah. Okay.
okay.
Judith, let's go to you here. Then we'll take a break.
Yeah. Just briefly. I mean, 90 district attorneys saying mm-hmm. they're going to exercise their judicial discretion is interesting, but in New York State alone, we have 57 district attorneys.
Yeah.
Because New York City is 5. So it's actually not a lot. And the question is, they have a responsibility to protect public safety. Mm-hmm. That is the oath they take. So how does this work itself out? We know all across law enforcement, there's a tremendous amount of discretion. Starting with, if you get pulled over by a police officer right. for mm-hmm. speeding, sometimes you can talk your way out of the ticket. That's the easy example. And then not that I'm good at that. And then it and then
or
it goes
any experience doing it.
right. And then it goes right into the judicial system. So, you know, you're going to have people saying it's the law. You have to equally enforce the law. That's really not how things work. So yeah. I would keep an eye on DAs, state attorneys general. And this is all going to wind up in court while, you know, the time ticks away. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the longer there's confusion, the worse mm-hmm. it's going to be.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we will continue. We have a wonderful group, Alan Chartok, Vera Carias-Kelly, Fran Berman, Judith Enck, and Teresa Bourgeois. We will be right back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Great group, Alan Chartok, Vera Carias-Kelly, Fran Berman, Judith Enck, and Teresa Bourgeois, talking about abortion and how this is really being enforced in this country and other aspects. Alan, anything you'd like to add?
No, we're here with a group of very distinguished and powerful women who have thought about this a great deal. So I pass to anyone who wants to grab it.
Barbara says, so this court protects the unborn but not children. Children are more susceptible to air pollution due to their smaller size and higher metabolism. If the court eliminates EPA regulations or limits the power of the agency, we travel back to the 1970s. This undue Obama agenda has got to end.
Judith.
Well, we all agree.
Totally agree. I'm bracing myself for a tough decision this morning. It doesn't mean that it's over on climate change, but it means that EPA would no longer have the authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from power plants, but we have to see what the decision says.
But so, it also could reach well beyond the EPA, right? The decision could have a reach well beyond the EPA.
Yeah, the way the Clean Air Act is written, states cannot be stronger than the EPA, with one big exception, California car regulations. But this is not like the abortion situation where states can protect reproductive rights. If the Supreme Court rules against the EPA, that means that states cannot be stronger because of the structure of the Clean Air Act.
So it strikes me about
all... that's new information for me, for sure.
This court case. What strikes me about all of this is the power of voting, and that it really, I mean, today really is a stark reminder, both with these potential court cases, with the abortion case this week, but also with Ketanji Brown Jackson being sworn in. It's a reminder that it really does make a difference when you vote. And I know that might sound a little Pollyannish, but it really is a stark, stark reminder.
It's incredibly important, but we've also skewed what your vote means. We've made it harder for many people to vote. And then gerrymandering, which, by the way, always mystifies me that we just don't use math to figure out districts instead of
anything
else. Fran
should have been the special master.
Yeah, that was never going to happen.
Our math master.
Yeah, I know. That's, you know, you're going to hear me say this until you kick me off the program. But,
never.
You know.
Never.
But, you know, the gerrymandering
makes
it hard for your vote to mean anything.
Yeah.
And, you know, so I agree with you, Teresa. I think the very first thing we can do is vote.
I just want to...
But not the last thing.
But not the last thing.
I just want to clarify something that Teresa brought out, which I think is really interesting, because she said that this has far-reaching effects. And it could undermine federal regulations on a host of issues, from drug pricing, financial regulations, to net neutrality, even.
Depending on how they resolve it, it may be a very narrow decision, but it has the potential to affect the ability of the administrative branch to make rules and regulations.
Right.
By worker protection.
Declaring it unlawful for federal agencies to make, quote, major decisions without clear authorization from Congress.
Which turns upside down every single federal regulation and you know, precedents, but they don't seem to care about
that. And by the way,
that.
The last time we got anything clear from Congress, it had to do with daylight savings time. So let's forget about that fantasy. Because Congress is very polarized.
Well, I mean, we have three branches of government, and this will, if in fact they proceed with a sweeping decision, this could really weaken one of those three in a fundamental way. And, you know, it was designed to be balanced among the three, and one could tip that balance depending
and
on
I
how
just,
broad the decision is.
Sorry, I just want to point out that of all the federal agencies, EPA gets sued the most.
Right.
It gets sued by polluters and by environmentalists. And so it's going to be really challenging for the agency to do their day-to-day work.
So as a EPA regional administrator, and maybe I'll hold this question. I'll hold this question until we know more about the decision. And then that question will be, with what we know about this decision, how would that impact your job of what you were doing? So I'll hold that. We got this letter from Andrea who says, remember how during the pandemic certain sheriffs announced they would not enforce the federal laws of mask wearing? I wonder now how the people who defended that quote-unquote discretion comment on this.
You know, Joe, when you were talking about that before, you know, it does seem like, you know, which side you're on, you decide if this is good or bad and if you're going to enforce it or not. But, you know, ideally, and I'm sorry always to be the Pollyanna with Teresa, you know, that's not the way the system is supposed to work. we're supposed to have different views, we're supposed to have civilized discourse, ha ha ha, and we're supposed to come up with something that's in the public interest. And, you know, if I don't like the outcome of that, it's supposed to be tough, but I'm supposed to have some personal freedom underlying that. And that whole system is called in question. You know, I don't like this particular decision from the Supreme Court. Should I make the Supreme Court bigger so we can put all the people on my side? You know, I think that's a tough one. Should I tell my law enforcement person, don't enforce this law, but enforce some law I like better? And so I really do think that the way the system is being operated to just optimize for one side of or another really concerns me. Really concerns me. I mean, where is that whole fabric of negotiation, of compromise, of freedom, but of, you know, an appropriate amount of oversight? You know, I don't know. I'm just frustrated.
Well, one of the fundamental questions I have is there are certain things about having access to clean air and clean water that all of us benefit from, right? Children, families, single people, elderly people, we all need to go and enjoy opportunities to breathe fresh air, right? And how can we make a decision that there is no need to protect that most fundamental right to breathe fresh and clean air? Those kinds of efforts to curtail that and make it accessible only for the wealthy because they can afford to go to a clean place, whereas people in urban environments or remote sites or indigenous people are going to have to be exposed to the poisons that we deposit in their areas of residence. I mean, to me, this is so appalling and so contrary what I learned the United States basic principle is in its democracy, that every conversation I have with my family, they're like, why are you still living in the United States? Mm-hmm. Maybe you should reflect on coming to places where we still have discussions about the public good.
But the ruling will be you don't have to, but that doesn't mean that you don't. Just because you don't have to, the companies, I know, this is, you know, wishful thinking, but individuals can make individual choices on their actions as regard to climate. Companies can make individual choices. Mm-mm. I know that they won't, but they can.
No, it's not. But they can, but it's not enough. We can live the greenest life possible. We are going, and we can deal with companies.
You can live the greenest life possible, Judith style.
No, it's a boring life.
It's a new book by Judith.
But when you have coal-fired power plants from West Virginia pumping massive amounts of greenhouse gas emissions into the environment worldwide, the climate crisis is here.
Yeah. I understand.
And I don't mean to be cynical that personal choices don't matter, but personal choices and a small number of companies that are investing in renewables will not counter a Supreme Court decision that says EPA no longer has the legal authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions.
I agree that this is potentially devastating and going in the wrong direction, but I also think that there are things that just because they decide doesn't mean that we can't pressure corporations to do the right thing. The legislation isn't saying you have to.
Climate crisis is here now, and corporations have had decades to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, and most have not. And so I don't mean to be negative, but we also have to be very sober about this. If greenhouse gas emissions cannot be regulated in the United States, a major emitter of greenhouse gases, this is really serious.
It is.
And no amount of, you know, extra credit by companies or us, you know, not driving as much as we normally would, it's just not going to counter it.
But the other thing is, so much of this is, I think, ending up in the courts because the Congress has been so stymied in getting things done.
It's because polluters sue all the time.
Corporations cannot and will not do anything that doesn't improve their bottom line, because that's the air they breathe.
But if the Democrats hold the House and the Senate, some of this can be corrected. If people don't get out, who care about this, don't get out to vote
this November,
it can't be corrected. And so there is a chance now in the upcoming election to, if you're really concerned about, which I think this is potentially devastating for environmental issues and a broad range of other issues.
Yeah.
But one of the corrections on this is to keep the House and Senate Democrat, strengthen it, and write some new rules. It's going to be hard, but that's one of the ways to fix this, and that requires people voting.
Well, we prepare to be devastated at 10 o'clock this morning, and hopefully not, but we'll see what happens.
Was this supposed to be a happy show?
No. Well, you wanted it.
You wanted it, and we all thought it was a little unrealistic.
I still have a note from you with all kinds of bare raises.
Women's soccer have pay equity. There's my happy news.
That is happy news. All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Alan Chartok, Vera Carias-Kelly, Fran Berman, Judith Eng, Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We welcome your letters. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So what if we, Amy writes, what if we simply change EPA to the church? Would the court allow greenhouse gas regulation then? Judith is thinking.
The Trump appointees would.
Dan writes, if the old Supreme Court judges want to change older judges' decisions made on abortion that make it illegal for white women primarily to choose, thank a Republican. It's like prohibition. It'll be available but dangerous. Everyone knows no great social changes are possible without feminine upheaval. Maybe an update on the environment indicators indicate imminent danger. I'm not sure I got that letter right, but I'm going to give it a shot. Okay.
Thank you for writing.
Thank you. That's the line. That's good, Teresa. Thank you. Gloria writes, there is a term for living creatures who are not permitted to control their own reproduction. That term is livestock.
Yikes.
Yep. I mean, it's right on. You know, as women are facing a lot of control, that they are, you know, barriers, ways through which their behaviors are managed, surveilled, and controlled. So, yes.
I disagree somewhat with the idea that votes matter, that we, quote unquote, we need to vote more. In New York and New England, there is a significant educated majority that has an academic understanding of policy. The court was stacked by the Senate, and the Senate is grossly overrepresenting a rural minority that lives in a cultural bubble and is not academically educated.
Oh.
These are not problems of voting, but of unequal representation. Well, there's a lot there to unpack. Alan, you want to take first crack?
Well, I don't know that there's a lot to say, except that we do have a voting population, that doesn't understand a good deal of what is going on, and doesn't make themselves heard. But I have more faith in the American people and their ability to ferret out what is, what is good for them.
So one of the things that I always find mysterious is that it doesn't matter how large the state's population is, but the way the Senate is set up in this country, it's profoundly undemocratic, as basic as that.
Well,
and, you know,
the way they set it up.
The
so
way
what
they set it up.
What do you propose?
Yeah, I don't constitutional amendments.
I'm with Fran on using some math. Mm-hmm. You know, math is good, actually.
But if you use math and you've made the system really robust to have the system the way it is, which is that you have reasonably fair representation of states, that's the Senate, and then you have reasonably fair representation of individuals, and that's the House. Now, where you could turn the dials is, you know, maybe the terms should be different. Maybe, you know, the way in which votes get through can be different. But I think from a mathematical point of view, oh, my gosh, political scientists will be writing in as I speak. it really does robustify it that the states get some representation because they have a lot of power and responsibility, and that the people get some representation, and that those are balanced with each other.
So let's try to remember that Rhode Island, you know, little tiny
Rhode Island.
Take a bus trip up there.
You know, and New York are having equal representation, at least in the Senate.
It does not make
any
sense.
Well, with California, which has, you know, like the eighth biggest country in the world.
It doesn't make any sense. That's why we have parliamentarians, parliamentarian systems, where you get both. You get popular representation, minority protections, and you have diversity of parties representing different interests.
But they're,
intended to balance each other.
But dare I say, I mean, wasn't the Electoral College supposed to address that?
Well, of course there's nothing, because the ones that are privileged prefer the system to remain the same. That's the way it always is. And, you know,
well, we have a winner-take-all election system. So if you run for office and one gets 51% and one gets 49%, the person who gets 49%'s interests are not represented, as opposed to proportional representation.
And, you know, what we have is a profoundly undemocratic system.
Not the people, it's the Electoral College vote. So if the Electoral College wasn't winner-take-all, they would be kind of a no-op. They would just represent what the percentages were in their states. That's not what we have.
Everything is
winner-take-all. Unfortunately, this is not what we have. We could make some improvements. You
well,
know,
ranked choice voting.
Yeah.
So there
ranked
are
choice voting is fabulous.
Minor efforts at that.
That's but good. That would be tinkered with also. But I will say I have a strong objection to this sort of broad brush describing and dismissing voters as uneducated.
Yeah, well, we
that was the letter writer.
I know.
That's,
I'm just
that's
saying,
not us.
I'm responding
we
to the
we
no,
agree
no,
with
I'm
you
responding
that,
to the letter
yes,
writer.
Yes, yes, we agree with you.
I just didn't want to be silent on that because that happens a lot, and I just I don't want to be silent on that because I really find that deeply troubling.
And I wrote a column recently in which I advised people to go and stand out in front of the legislature and ask who the governor was, who the, you know, and who your congressman was. And I think you'd, based on what you're saying, Teresa, I think you'd be very disappointed.
And that's because people turn off to politics because they don't think elected officials are working in the public interest.
Right. Or in their interest.
Or in their interest. So, you know, this is the cynicism factor here is very worrisome. People feel like, you know, they have no skin in the game when it even comes to voting. That's why so many people don't vote. And then so many young people got involved in elections. They, you know, definitely a lot of young people, college students, worked for Obama. The world didn't change. Then they saw the risk with Trump and some, you know, reluctantly campaigned for Biden. And now we're asking Democrats control both houses of Congress and the executive. And why aren't things changing? And the worry is that a lot of these young people then will just tune out and say it doesn't make any difference.
Well,
and
also I have a different view of it, to be honest with you.
But I have a practical suggestion here. I would like everyone to sit down and be delighted about this. but it isn't my practical suggestion. So the WAMC Harvard connection. So I went to Radcliffe Day because I was a Radcliffe Fellow, and you know that's one of the things I did. So I went back to Radcliffe Day, and they were giving the big fancy Radcliffe Medal to Sherrilyn Ifill this year. And
wonderful.
Someone asked Sherrilyn Ifill,
explain who she is.
Oh my God!
Former and
well, of course. Well, of course, that's right. Say it again.
Okay. No, go on.
Well, Sherrilyn Ifill was recently stepped down as the head of NAACP. No, another legal defense fund.
Legal defense fund, I think.
Civil rights legal
she's
defense
a civil
fund.
Rights, she's
lawyer.
A leader in civil rights issues in the country in various positions.
Who was kind of on the short list for Supreme Court justice.
Yeah, she
and Gwen Ifill's sister.
And an amazing
and
person.
And Gwen Ifill's sister, that's right.
She was one of my immediate
Someone said, asked her, it was a conversation, and said, you know, it's like, what can one person do? Mm-hmm. You know, there's Congress, there's the Senate, there's all this bad stuff going on. And what she said is that a lot of the power in your community happens locally. It's who's on school board. Right. It's who's on the planning commission. You know, it's who's, you know, running for judge locally. And many people look at that ballot, and I'm really embarrassed to tell our listeners in this esteemed group that I'm one of them. And if they don't know someone, they might skip it. or they might vote for, you know, someone of their party or someone their of their gender, or, you know, however rough thing they do. And by not actually figuring out who those folks are and making as informed opinion as you would for other things, that you're really giving away a lot of power. There's stuff left on the table. And so, you know, she really inspired me to, like, go look at all those races and actually make informed decisions and try to make my vote count, looking at Teresa right now, by actually voting better.
I know Alan disagreed on some of that, so I want to get to that, but yes.
Just a quick thing. I want to recommend this amazing column that was in the New York Times two days ago, How I Build a Good Day When I'm Full of Despair at the World, by Mary Pfeiffer. She's an author. I'm going to just read this every single morning, and I highly recommend people look at it. And my neighbor Diane tells me that Gwen Ifill was the head of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Gwen is her cousin, not sister.
Oh my goodness.
NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
Mm-hmm. Alan, you had some concerns about this.
Yes, but I forgot them.
Okay, that's all right.
So I wanted to say a very nice, you know, way for privileged women like us to think about how to have a good day, right? We can do gardening. We can reflect. We have access to greenery. Many, many women do not. Many women get up, take care of their families, mm-hmm. their children, have to work multiple jobs to bring home sufficient money to afford the increase in pricing. I mean, really, who but those who already have privilege and already are highly educated have access and opportunity to reflect and enjoy nature as much. So we have to be also thinking about our sisters and brothers in community who may not have as much privilege as we have. And there are ways of doing it. I think a lot of us women are well connected to other families in our communities, and we can share our resources a little bit more through access to opportunities, weekend walks, guided walks, helping refugees, supporting them in finding better jobs, helping them with housing or food support. There are many ways through which we can help those and support those who are less privileged. And I think in many ways we need to do a lot more of that to be good neighbors and to be good friends.
And I think a lot of that is happening, people supporting each other in quietly effective ways. I mean, we need a lot more of it, but I see in my own community, there's a group called Mary's Corner. These volunteers come twice a week, 2 hours, and they collect clothes and baby formula and diapers and other things, and then they disperse it to those who can't afford it because they, you know, with inflation they can't meet. And there's food distribution. There's a group of volunteers who pack backpacks full mm-hmm. of food for students to bring home on the weekend mm-hmm. who don't have food. I mean, there's a whole host of that going on quietly all over the country. We need more of it, but it's happening.
By the way, I just want to share that to our listeners that
we have to take a break, but go ahead.
Oh, sorry. That Teresa and Judith and Vera are really live what they do between Vera's work with refugee communities, between Teresa's work in Cajos, which has been amazing, Judith's work with plastics and the local communities. I mean, I'm really inspired by all of you guys. Well, and of course, there's Alan and Great Barrington, so thank you, Alan.
Barrington.
And there's math.
And there's math.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We are awaiting a Supreme Court decision. We'll talk about that. We'll also talk about the changes in the Supreme Court that will happen, a history-making day on the Supreme Court, and much, much more with our wonderful panel. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Alan Chartok, Vera Karius-Kelly, Fran Berman, Teresa Bourgeois, and Judith Henk. We announced, we were talking about in our last hour, that we were waiting for the Supreme Court decision in regards to the EPA. We were expecting it to come out right at 10 o'clock, and it did, 10:03 to be exact. The Supreme Court sharply curtails the authority of the EPA to regulate greenhouse gas emissions that cause climate change. It was a 6-3 ruling. Justice John Roberts wrote the
the majority opinion. The court sides with conservative states and fossil fuel companies in adopting a narrow reading of the Clean Air Act. Judith, I turn it over to you.
Yeah, it's much more than narrow. This is a devastating decision. It's kind of shaking me, to be honest. 6-3 telling EPA they cannot limit greenhouse gases from power plants. And the origin of this case is it started in a case called Massachusetts versus EPA, where the court said, yes, indeed, the Clean Air Act does give EPA authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions at power plants. That has been upheld for decades. That is the precedent. And as is the case with this Supreme Court, they have thrown that out and said that EPA does not have this authority. And in fact, just from a clean air perspective, this is different than the abortion situation because under the Clean Air Act, states cannot be stronger than the EPA. So we can't say, oh, well, New York State DEC can regulate this. No, they have to follow the federal rules. And then the collateral damage here is the court dealt with issues of major questions and said that regulatory agencies at the federal level, the FDA, the insurance department, you know, pick your federal agency, they're going to have to get Congress to pass laws on major questions. So that's virtually everything. And we know how gridlocked the Congress is. This decision in its narrowest forms means we will all be breathing dirtier air. It means we won't have the ability to substantially reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. It doesn't touch the transportation sector. It doesn't. This decision is just on power plants, but because of the major issue here, it could touch other greenhouse gas sources like transportation, industrial sources. I think this is the worst environmental decision from the Supreme Court in history.
Yes. Really?
Well, I don't know my history well enough. I don't doubt you. But certainly the reach of this, the impact on climate, but way beyond that, if I understand this correctly, is transformational and not in a good way.
You know, remember the days when, I'm thinking to the Reagan administration, where that too much government overreach. And now just in the last
week,
we've seen all of these decisions where you can't do anything without additional congressional approval.
Let's remember 6-3 on the Supreme Court, which we keep seeing. Mm-hmm. It tells us that when you're campaigning for a presidential candidate and you say, wait a second, that candidate, if so-and-so wins, it's going to be bad news from the Supreme Court. Everybody says, oh, no, sure.
Yeah.
But of course, it does, and we're seeing it right now, big time.
I remember some scholars, some legal scholars saying, a lot of stuff doesn't get to the Supreme Court. The action is in the lower federal courts.
You know,
well, that's been blown out of the water in the last week.
It has. Yeah.
But they told us what they were going to do during the Trump-Clinton election, and they named the judges, the Federal Society list. You know, they were very transparent about this. And the question is, for all of those who are deeply disturbed about this today, what are you going to do? What are you going to do in November?
That's the question.
What are you going to do in November? Because, you know, people stayed home in the Clinton-Trump election and they didn't vote. And that had, you know, and here we are. This week is because people didn't, you know, they stayed home. They didn't vote.
It's not just that Teresa. It's because special interests have a death grip on our government process in the United States. It was polluters. And in this instance, the state of West Virginia that brought this case. We no longer have democratic decision making. We all just say, oh, it has to go to the Congress. And then we know that Congress is not going to act, even though Democrats are in the majority in both houses. This is about money in politics. It's about polluters flooding the field with campaign contributions and lobbyists, just like on reproductive health. It was a 50-year strategy. This was kind of a 30-year strategy, right, to gut the Clean Air Act, and today, yeah, the polluters won.
Yeah.
But it's also a long-term strategy to take control of the court. And that's the mm-hmm. democracy. That's their right to do that. But if one doesn't participate in the if you're upset about this, but you didn't participate in the process, I don't disagree with you about the polluters. I absolutely agree. But the reason they won their case is because of the makeup of the Supreme Court.
I agree with you entirely, and I understand what you're saying. And what you're saying, of course, is right. That is the argument that President Biden has been using over and over again over the past week and a half. But as you listen to it, it does sound like a weak argument, and you hope for more.
Yeah. One of the things I wanted to mention, though, that this decision also has international fallout, right? We have now a number of countries that are highly critical of what's happening in the United States. In general, I think we see a loss of reputation as for the United States globally, right, as a leader in many ways, now also on the environmental front. And we have a number of countries that are reflecting on what kind of regulations they will implement so that they are not stuck with having to be responsible for the kind of pollution that blows their way, right? There are lots of conversations happening throughout Latin America and Asia in terms of how to protect their own natural resources from Canadian and U.S. corporate interests to reflect. Now, you know, maybe later on we'll talk about the situation in Colombia. We have a very powerful change in Colombia with the vice president, an environmental activist now, a leftist-leaning new government coming in. She is, Vice President Marquez, is an Afro-Colombian woman. She started as a 13-year-old as an environmental activist. And they're proposing some new interesting legislation that would also directly challenge the United States and its way of corporate operations in Latin America, specifically a longstanding ally as Colombia, right? So there are a number of conversations that are happening in the Caribbean, in Latin America, in Europe, in terms of what's happening with the United States, and it's the relationship that we have in many ways, right? So this is an interesting moment for me to watch, where we have a sequence of decisions made by this Supreme Court, and it will have global implications for the U.S.
Well, you saw that in the G7 meetings this mm-hmm. week. But also, again, this is devastating. There's no doubt about it. But this doesn't require corporate America to still use coal.
I mean, they will, because it's cheap. That's what they've used for years. They're gonna use the power source that's cheapest. They'll do a little wind, a little solar, and say, we're done with that. This is a devastating decision for the world. The United States and China are the largest mm-hmm. emitters of greenhouse gases. We are hit record temperatures this summer. People are dying from climate change. We can vote. We should vote. We could watch the GE commercials on wind turbines. It's not going to counter this.
The Boston Globe puts this in context and says that this actually, I just want to find the line now. The justices heard arguments in this case on the same day that the United Nations panel report warned that mm-hmm. the effects of climate change IPCC. Are about to get right. much worse, likely mm-hmm. making the world sicker, hungrier, poorer, and more yep. dangerous in the coming years. The arguments heard in that case and that report released on the same day.
Judith, mm-hmm. can you talk a little bit more about the arguments put forth justifying this decision? Because, it's obvious that it says that the science doesn't matter mm-hmm. and that we right. are abandoning our responsibility to the public interest mm-hmm. As the oversight body for the government, for the public interest. What's the justification for this decision?
I think it's they're relying on a process question. Richard Nixon set up the EPA 52 years ago and said, hire a bunch of scientists and engineers and lawyers and figure out ways to protect our environment and delegate programs to the states because the states are closer to the people. So most Clean Air Act programs or EPA kind of sets the rules of the road and then the state implements it. And, you know, one would argue that it hasn't worked beautifully, but there was, you know, a structure there.
Yeah.
The thing about air pollution and climate change is the science gets worse and worse every
right.
year. So until the Trump administration, federal environmental regulations got tightened as new science came out. And then the Trump administration, everything went haywire. This decision is basically saying EPA cannot do its job unless
right.
Congress explicitly gives it authority on major questions. And this is like every day EPA is dealing with PFAS in drinking water, how much pesticides in the diets of infants and children,
right.
what are radiation levels going to be at nuclear power plants. And, you know, when you regulate for greenhouse gases at power plants, you get co-benefits
yeah.
of reducing particulate pollution, mm-hmm. Air pollution that causes acid rain and smog. So if the EPA professional career staff have to put on the brakes and get congressional approval on anything that's described as a major question, everything comes to a screeching halt.
I just want
to
know.
But why do the justices say that this is okay? What is
what
their
was
justification?
The basis for the decision? It was a process
yeah.
question, but what is the
Sorry,
what
Joe.
Does it turn on?
No, I just wanted to mention that the Supreme Court has also just released a decision in the last 3 minutes where they are siding with the Biden administration in the Remain in Mexico case. The decision mm-hmm. rules that the Biden huh? administration has the authority to end the Trump era program. So
Good.
That from the that from the Supreme Court this morning as well. I just wanted to make sure.
Well, what do we bring away that? From that one? Is it the idea that perhaps somebody somewhere is deciding that people who that we need those people in this country.
Yeah, John Roberts wants cheap labor.
Yeah.
That was
well,
it was a 5-4 decision.
Exactly.
Justice Roberts wrote the court's opinion and was joined by Justice Kavanaugh and the court's three liberals. That's
Kavanaugh.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
And,
well, Kavanaugh wants housekeeper staff.
Well, also, I would say, I mean, that's cynical, yes, but also let's think about the acceleration of smuggling and the horrible situation we just had
gosh.
In Texas with
yes.
the truck full of right. dead people.
53.
Yeah. Right? Yes. That was horrific and just a reminder and the culmination of a sequence of events like that. This has happened over and over again because of the Remain in Mexico policy. That is cruel and inhuman the way it was carried out.
Explain to people why that.
So it basically didn't. It declared Mexico a safe place, even if drug smugglers or gangs were going after you and after Central American migrants, and you couldn't even reach the border with the U.S. to request asylum, which is a fundamental right to at least request asylum in this country, which was denied to people, and they were held in Mexico because Mexico was declared a safe place. Now, let me critique at the same time the European Union and Britain does that as well. You know, the UK now deports immigrants to Rwanda to holding camps, right? Just saying, this is a common practice for countries to curb immigration, but it is cruel. It is exposing people that are desperate to the most horrific conditions in so-called claimed safe countries that are not safe.
Okay, so just for our listeners, mm-hmm. what is it that you would espouse that would make it better?
Well, obviously, it's a fundamental right to be able to apply for asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the right to right. come to the border, talk to a border agent and say, my family's being threatened by smugglers or drug lords or whoever. My daughter is being
yep.
forcibly recruited. They have a right in court to make a case for why they need protections, right?
Right.
And
that
the delay
is
in those
right.
cases right now are backed up, what, 2-3 years?
So
what
let's just say I'm, as you know, Fran referenced, we have Afghan former interpreters and other refugees in this country who are still waiting to be processed for anything. They're here under humanitarian parole. Nothing has been done legally for them. They're, again, being held in the U.S. without in this sort of in-between status. Ukrainians are coming in the same situation for the first time now in Albany at the Refugee Welcome Center here in West Hill, where I collaborate with a lot of community members. We had a Ukrainian request for assistance because they were denied access by DSS for food stamps or any additional help, right? So this is happening over and over again. The bureaucracy in this country is broken. People are allowed in without process to, you know, gain rights that were promised or discussed. Congress isn't acting on anything. People wait for months and months and months, and nothing is moving forward. Now, what do we have to do? Well, we have a crisis in countries in Central America. Of course, we need labor here.
Absolutely.
And we have people desperate for labor. Why not come up with contracts so people can go back and forth, right?
And so answer your own question. Why not?
Why not? Because right now the mode is to reject anybody who comes in as undeserving. Well, we have economic interests.
What's behind the mode?
Behind that is generally hostility towards people who are coming from particular parts of the world. There's a suspicion that these people are remaining in the country. Well, they only remained in this country when we fundamentally closed the border and didn't allow them to go back and visit family and re-enter for work contracts. So that's one issue. Second issue, we have the dry corridor cutting across Central America. We have environmental devastation that is unstoppable at this point, and millions of people will come and die. Unless we figure out some kind of way to collaborate and figure out some kind of a labor arrangement for those people to go back and forth.
I had the good fortune of watching Texas Governor Greg Abbott's press conference yesterday.
Good Lord.
And I'm being very cynical when I say that. But talk about the political yoga poses he was doing, but blamed President Biden for the deaths of 53 people in San Antonio, and saying that the deaths are on Biden for what he referred to as Biden's deadly open border policies. How can you come to that?
Well, how about what Abbott is now promising to do, special checks on all trucks and bring everything to a halt again? He tried that before. Right. That worked out like a charm,
and let's
right?
remember he's a presidential candidate in his own mind, at least.
Yeah, in his own mind, at least. Yes. I would agree with that. I mean, he is manipulative in how he frames issues around migration and environmental concerns.
Yeah. And he's also incompetent. They can't even keep the lights on, the terrible power outage. And he blamed Biden on that. But Texas is the only state in the country with their own isolated electricity grid.
It's on them.
So, I mean, Abbott really is not impressive.
Go Beto O'Rourke. Here's where I'm going to agree with Teresa. In Texas, you know, having a different governor will make a big difference for sure.
In Georgia, keeping Senator Warnock will make a big difference to Georgia.
Electing Stacey Abrams.
Electing Stacey Abrams. I mean, if for those, you know, I mean, it depends.
So where do we focus? On getting good governors, or focused on the midterm elections to get more Democrats in Congress? And then, you know, if you do have more Democrats in Congress, how do you get them to do their jobs?
And is it really either or?
Yeah, well, we need to do all these things.
Yeah, but in terms of hours in the day and the amount of money in your checking account, if you haven't lost your checkbook, Fran, it does make, we do have to prioritize.
For our listeners, you know, my wallet was stolen in New York City.
Look at all the thinking, all the ideas that we just share, right? We know we have a lot of skill right here. We can do different things at the same time and understand how it's interconnected. We can build networks to push back, and I'm confident that we can do a lot in the coming months in terms of talking to people, encouraging them, giving them avenues to organize.
Getting women elected.
Yes.
Of course, we have no choice.
Yes,
we're not just
going
to sit back and garden. No offense to gardeners.
Well, we should do a little gardening. That's what your article
says.
That's
what
a little gardening
says.
Every day.
I know.
Read a little Thich Nhat Hanh, which everybody, you know, read some Thich Nhat Hanh, do
Let's
a little gardening.
All right. So we have to pause. We have a lot of letters on what has
just transpired over the last half hour regarding the Supreme Court and the two major decisions that they ruled on. We'll get to those letters right after this short break. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. Our last go-round here with our wonderful panel, Alan Shartok. Don't even know what I was starting to say there. Vera Carius, Kelly, Fran Berman, Judith Enk, and Teresa Bourgeois. We welcome you to our program, and we also welcome you to write a question if you have one. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Not surprisingly, we have many, so let's go to those. Roger says the only way to prevent an overly conservative court from dominating an increasingly liberalized and diverse country when a highly polarized and largely dysfunctional Congress is the new norm is term limits of 12 to 18 years or perhaps at age 70. Nominations spaced out in odd years, so each president gets regular nomination hearings assured and the Senate required to follow through with hearings and a vote. McConnell's maneuvering to get Trump three appointments is the most despicable act of a Senate majority leader in modern times. I believe your hands hit your cheeks as that.
It was a full,
okay.
A full face.
It was a full face. Got it.
This reaction is pretty typical, and I just think term limits vote, you know, the term limits are vote. I think that changing the structure of the
voting
court
is the term limit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Let the people, voting is the term limit. I know, Alan, you and I disagree on term limits.
Yes.
But voting is who's the voter should set the term limit.
Well, it's
I'm not jazzed about term limits because I think that in general, you need people with experience
absolutely
to run things. On the other hand, you know, you can't let things go forever. And I kind of like this listener's idea about long-term limits for the Supreme Court, long-term limits for the Senate. You know, I think a lot of these folks, you know, they just capitalize in the long tail of irrelevance.
Why doesn't it work, Alan?
No, it doesn't work because, you know, people get in there and then they don't leave and then they do this stuff that.
But that's a short-term limit, Alan. What about
staff
a longer
run
one?
Everything.
Yeah,
I'm sorry?
Then the professional staff run everything.
And the lobbyists get more powerful.
Well, you know, they always say that, Judith. They always say it's going to be the staff that takes over. But I don't believe it. I don't believe it because I think what happens is the new people get in there and they bring their own people. Surprise, surprise, you know, with them. And so that the staff changes, too. So that staff is going to rule everything. Argument doesn't do it for me. Judith, over to you.
Well, look at our Albany example. Richard Gottfried was in the state assembly
for 130 years.
For 52 years, maybe, or 50 years.
Longest serving ever.
And, you know, he served with great distinction, and he was an expert on healthcare and other issues. And he had strong staff. And so do you want to kick someone like Dick Gottfried out of the legislature?
You didn't kick him. You didn't kick him out. He
retired.
Him. He kicked himself out.
Yeah, but if you had term limits, he would have been gone, you know, 30 years ago.
And you would have lost that expertise. You would have lost that expertise.
Well, yes, you guys are all such goo-goos, but the fact of the matter is, well, you don't like that joke.
I'm amused by it.
So if you don't, you leave a guy in power. If the guy is good, Gottfried, you're great. It's great. And if the guy is bad, or the woman is bad, that's another.
I was just going to plead for some women.
Diane Feinstein is 89 years old, and maybe, you know.
Maybe somebody should
retire. There should be a retirement age for some.
And just like Strom Thurmond, but they didn't get the pressure around Strom Thurmond. Mm-hmm. They both, it's time. But the expertise matters, and if you lose that expertise, then your lobbyists get more powerful, and then your staff get more powerful. But on the Supreme Court,
au contraire.
On the Supreme Court, which this letter think was about,
it's
the young members of the Supreme Court. It's the young members of the Supreme Court,
and they are purposely appointed when they are young, so they'll stay there forever.
Right.
So let's keep on going with the letters here. I want to get to many of them. Ed says on the Supreme Court ruling, make no mistake, this is about the unrestrained manufacturer of crap, not just the packaging either, the crap itself that everyone, including environmental activists, depend on and is convinced is necessary to sustain a healthy economy. I would not say every environmental activist, but
but still.
And if people had to pay the full life cycle cost of these products, that would the situation be a lot different?
Let's see. Joe taking me to task for interrupting Judith at the most important part. I broke in to tell about the decision about the Mexico and migrant decision. But Judith was about to explain the justice's justification for the EPA ruling. I'm mystified and would like to hear the answer.
Well, I appreciated the interruption because it was good news for a change. Basically, it's a process question. So mining companies and coal-burning power plants argued that the EPA did not have the legal authority to regulate greenhouse gases at power plants. And
think of the name EPA, right. Environmental Protection Administration.
Right. And every court pretty much disagreed with that. And what happened today was that long-term precedent was thrown out the window. And on a process question, the court said on anything that's considered a major question, so this has far bigger implications beyond coal burning. The court said on major questions, federal agencies, in this instance the EPA, they have to get explicit permission from Congress to act. Now, on one hand, you know, people would argue, well, it's a big policy decision. Congress should decide this. On the other hand, the whole foundation of the EPA is they have broad legal authority to provide clean air, safe drinking water, limited pesticides on foods. And if they've got to go back to the Congress on major questions, the agency is going to come to a screeching halt. And rest assured, pesticide companies will say, what do you mean I can't have high levels of pesticide residue on tomatoes? That's a major question. You can't regulate that, EPA.
Right.
You need to go to the Congress. This is a disaster.
Who defines major questions? But think about, in the midst of a pandemic, this also reaches to the FDA.
Right.
So what's a major
question? And OSHA
and
the FCC
in the middle of a pandemic
and Plan B.
And what does it mean? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to go back to the Congress and get approval? So passed in both House and Senate and signed by the President, is that the approval? Presumably.
I guess that's what that means,
and
right?
Who decides yes or no? It's a major question. So imagine in the midst of the pandemic, when things were moving so quickly, if they had to go back to the Congress. This is the thing I'm trying to ponder is, what is the Biden administration's next move on this? Because this can't stand.
It's the Supreme Court.
So what do they do? Yeah.
One of my fundamental concerns with what you just mentioned, Teresa, is what we have an issue with in this country is experts, especially scientific experts, making decisions or guiding decisions that are in the interest of the general public's, in terms of health and environment and other factors. Here we have this sort of the major question concern going to Congress, where we have people that are often not area experts, not scientists, not even believing in some
and
of the science.
Controlled by lobbyists.
Controlled by lobbyists or managed by lobbyists or benefiting in some way from getting certain supports. So this is an anti-science decision that was
made
today.
Anti-expert,
Anti-expert, anti-intellectual, anti-science decision. So this is what the Supreme Court just endorsed. It is fundamentally questioning how we as citizens interact with the scientific fields. This
but
should
how
worry
the
reg-
but,
a
but
lot
how
of people.
The regulatory structure in the federal, this fundamentally shifts how the federal regulatory structure works in this country, if I'm understanding it correctly. Mm-hmm. And it has to work. I mean, it's worked slowly, but this changes the cadence of the process, therefore the cadence at which it works. And in emergency situations, how does that function? And does it tip the balance? You know, we were supposed to be.
But all of this.
Go ahead.
Oh,
I just want to hear from the listeners. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, all of this, I think, is emblematic of a really sea change in the underlying philosophy in everything, which is we have gone to a country where things sort of were driven by the public interest, evidence, you know, science, for the most part, ebbs and flows, to things where money and winning count more than anything. And all of these things are about sort of money, power, winning. And, you know, I mean, to me, that's the fundamental sea change we're seeing. And it's hard to know what to do to kind of reverse that.
Let me just roll through some of these. I'm sorry, carefully navigate through some of our mail. we only have 3 minutes. Leslie says, between Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale and her Madame trilogy, she looks like a freaking genius predicting our future. I would argue she is a freaking genius. Let's see. We go to Joan. Could the Court of Public Opinion mitigate, if not negate, today's ruling by the EPA? I recall when tuna fisheries insisted it was impossible not to kill slash injure dolphins when catching tuna. Once the public was broadly engaged in this issue, dolphin friendly was a necessary badge of honor. Mm-hmm. Ditto organic, quote unquote, humane and non-GMO. We go to Wendren, who says, we are currently doomed, but we must not give up in advance. Can we refocus on not only getting out the vote, but also forcing the financial sector to divest its financing from these fossil fuel polluters and their work of planetary extinction? No money, no subsidies, no fossil fuels. We go to Chris, could it be that agreeing with Biden's Remain in Mexico position reserves presidential powers for future presidents to act unilaterally? Then Jarette says states are not capable of managing environmental concerns in a bubble. Borders don't keep pollution and pollution policies behind a line. It seems obvious that a national standard is required, doesn't it? Are we to regulate now within 50 states and by agreements made between them individually and regionally? This is nuts. That from Jarette. We have time for a few more letters, and we go to this from Eileen. Let's not forget to place the blame squarely on Mitch McConnell for hijacking the process of blocking Obama and then rushing the nominees of choice through. We also go to, I just had a thought. Mark said, has there ever been a more activist court? Donald Trump gets his way again. Our system is so very, very broken.
Three days. Accurate.
Well, we say blame and they say, you know, cheers and all of this. So, I mean, that's the divided country we're in.
The Supreme Court will always say whether to end or continue the stay in Mexico rule that Trump imposed and Biden wants to end. Can any of the panelists explain why Trump could make the rule by executive order, but Biden wasn't allowed to simply overturn stay in Mexico? Anybody have thoughts on that?
I was wondering that myself. I don't know what the underlying decision was driven by, but it'll be interesting to see.
All right. Three more letters. 1 minute. Jack says, a serious issue that hasn't been addressed is that the House of Representatives has been capped at 435 representatives, which has resulted in states like Wyoming having four times as much power in the legislative body that is supposed to represent the people. The judicial state, question mark? The conservatives' talking point for decades has been about how bad the administrative state was to our democracy. Has anyone noticed how silent the conservative and constitutionalist hypocrites have been about the judicial state gaining control and their destruction of our democracy and freedoms? These justices have lifetime appointments, are unelected, and are not beholden to American citizens or its voters. The Supreme Court and the judicial branch are tainted by their illegitimacy.
Yep.
And finally, Sally says, the first question I want to ask Justice Breyer as he's walking out of the Supreme Court is, what is your advice on how to fix the Supreme Court of the United States of America? We will end there. My thanks to our wonderful panel this morning. Alan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Joe.
Wonderful to have this group here today. Vera Carius-Kelly, Fran Berman, Judith Eng, Teresa Bourgeois. I love you all, but special thanks to Fran for driving here.
Oh,
yes.
Absolutely. You get points for travel.
I'll wave to you all driving back to Pioneer Valley.
And I think we need a do-over and to do the show on a less devastating day.
Yeah. Well, you find a less devastating day and you let me know about it. Yeah.
But it worked out well that you were here today, though, right?
Really
the expert.
We'll be right back.